before we were married. My husband was working at Walgett in New South Wales, and then at Mitchell in southwest Queensland, and while I was a year at what is now known as Cherbourg in Queensland. On our marriage in 1928, we both went to Mitchell, and the following year our son Frank was born, much to the delight of these dark folk, because a baby is loved by everybody. We had a very happy time there, and the Lord was very pleased to bless what we were doing, and in the course of time he had another purpose for us, to take the gospel where Christ was not known. So with this view, we severed our connection with the Aborigine Inland Mission, with whom we worked very happily, and in 1930 we set out to go to where the Lord was leading us. We had been to Brisbane and seen the protector of Aborigines there, and we told him that we wanted to go somewhere where Aborigines were not cared for at all. And he said, "Oh, how about Burketown?" Well, we didn't know where Burketown was at that stage. He told us it was up in the Gulf of Carpentaria, and there were people there who were not being cared for in any way. So we're having this information and seeking the Lord's mind on it. We finally set out from Mitchell on a trek overland to Burketown. It was 1930 when we started out for Burketown. We left Mitchell in August of that year and went in an old Hudson car that had been given to us by friends in Brisbane a couple of years before. We went to various stations along the way, and at each place we were well received by the station owners or managers, and also by the dark folk who were working on the properties. Frank was over a year old by this time, and he was very happy travelling, very happy wherever we went. And we went first of all to Bapalura station and then to Bogabilla, and from there we went up to Augathella and Winton. We had many adventures along the way and camped out very often under the stars, although we did have a small tent. We cooked by the creeks and washed and that, in very primitive conditions really, but it was a joy. And on the whole, the weather was very good and there were no problems. However, when we got to Winton, we were there for some weeks, and then we camped by the river there, and then rain set in. But the Salvation Army officers there, with whom we had become very friendly, invited us to stay at their quarters, which we were very happy to do. My husband had been helping the Salvation Army in their open air work, and we were very happy to help the lassies, and they in turn were very, very kind to us. The creek in Winton was called the State Creek, and this was so named because of the big mistake that was made by the authorities in many years ago in killing off some 300 Aborigines as a reprisal for the murder of a white family some distance away. We had one disaster of black oil en route to Winton when Frank ran into a camp oven hole, that is a hole full of hot ashes where we put the camp oven to bake our bread, and that delayed us for some little time there as his one little foot was very badly burned. We had a few other troubles along the way, like up near Balcaldon. The river bank was so steep and so narrow at the bottom that we literally went down and nose first, and how we climbed out I wouldn't know, but we did. The Lord helped us and we eventually climbed out of there, but it was a very risky kind of a business. Our aim was to reach Cloncurry, where I was to stay with Mr. Simmons and Campbell, who were living there and established a work among dark and white folk in the town. And I was to stay there until our second child was born in December. Then, of course, wanted to get up into Burttown before the wet season started. But one way and another, we had so many delays along the way that it was the end of the year, end of 1930, before he was able to arrive in Burttown. Another reason for urgency was that we were expecting a young man from Sydney who had offered to come and help Will Sharp. He was to arrive in Burttown on the 27th of October by boat. And of course, Len wanted to be there to welcome him. And now I'm going to quote from letters that Len had written to his father, to whom I'm indebted for having carefully kept a record of all letters written to him from 1930 to the end of 1935. Left in the morning of the 20th of October and arrived back at 6:30 p.m. the same day. The road to Burttown is a bush track winding through the trees or across the plain. I got about 3 miles out and took the wrong track, taking me 5 miles out of the way, and I had to retrace. Next, the chain that drives the speedometer broke, and then I skidded in heavy sand, breaking the front hood against a tree and bent the windscreen brackets. When I reached Quambie, 30 miles out, the car stopped dead and I found the carburetor choke. After clearing that and getting the car going again, I found I had lost a case of benzene, so I turned back to find it. Travelled 5 miles and the tyre blew out. There was a slip a foot long. It was irreparable and I had no spare, and crawled the 25 miles back to town on 3 tyres and an empty rim. Praise God, it was only the car that was damaged, and not me also. It all seems as though the devil is making a big attempt to prevent us from opening work at Burttown. Dorothy was reading a book by Miss Amy Carmichael and came on these strikingly beautiful words. On the far reef, the breakers recoil in shattered foam. Yet still the sea behind them urges its force at home. Its chant of triumph surges through all the thunderous din. The waves may break in failure, but the tide is sure to win. We would have arrived at Burttown on Thursday, the 30th of October. I sent him a telegram and a letter explaining things. I shall be with him next Tuesday, as I expect to get the train on Monday next from Cloncurry to Dobbin, and thence by mail truck to Burttown, approximately 260 miles, 80 by train and 180 by truck. Now, written on the 15th of November, Burttown at last. There promises to be a great work up here if all pans out as we think and the Lord opens up the way. I have already written for particulars re a large Aboriginal reserve, Clint Parker, which will be subsidised by the government if it comes to anything. Please pray the Lord's will be done in this matter, for it will be a stupendous undertaking and only possible with his aid. We shall need skilled workers in all classes of work besides the spiritual, and I shall manage until someone more capable is provided, but of course this is only in the air at present. I have not a house yet, but I'm looking to the Lord for one. Will and I are quite well. We are camped at the racecourse, boarding at the hotel being far too expensive, and there's no other place. There is one empty house in town, but it is owned by the government department and is up for sale for £75. Our first storm broke on Monday morning. This is about a fortnight later. We had just dry bread and water for tea, as we had to sit up all night with the water was pouring under our feet, and we perched on benzene tins to keep our feet dry. It was a wild night, but praise God for a sustaining grace. We took shelter in the jockey's dressing room under the grandstand, the best we could find at the racecourse. We have a tent fly rigged over us as the rain pours through the floorboards and spray even comes through the fly. It is worth it all for Christ's sake, and he has kept us from cold. Last night we slept in the grandstand. I woke and saw enormous black clouds bowling along. I called Will and we scrambled for shelter. The wind drives about 40 miles per hour in these storms. We have been thinking of buying iron and building a shed. We did not build our shed, as the Lord did not give any clear guidance about this. It was a very, very definite matter for prayer on Sunday. On Monday afternoon, we went uptown and saw the shire clerk getting ready to move into the cottage we were after. We were very disappointed, but immediately applied for the place where he had been living, a skillion on the side of a stall, offering a month's rent in advance at 15 shillings a week, which was accepted. We are grateful to have got this, as it will be a shelter from the storm. We praise God for it. It is a day of small things, but we have been able to witness for Christ to the Chinese storekeeper, the young half-caste Chinese, an Aboriginal from Camarillo, who can read. We gave him a traveller's guide and a New Testament. Last Tuesday, we went fishing with Jimmy the Tracker, and Tiger took their spears, and we took rifles and lines. I shot a pigeon, Jimmy speared a mullet. We caught two bream, which made a nice change in diet. Apart from that, we disturbed an alligator and caught a grey nurse shark. The river is infested with them. The plain is alive with kangaroos, and it is very amusing at times to see anything up to half a dozen pairs having a box. They hammer away with their hands, and suddenly one jumps and kicks the other in the stomach. There is then a cessation of hostilities while they lick down their ruffled coats. Then into it again. This morning I found two new friends of the bush. A pair of fat pie was sporting in a pool nearby. Also a beautiful goanna, about 3 foot six long. It was of varying green hues, a really beautiful thing to look at. I had worked in Front Curry, but our son Leonard Victor was born on the 21st of December. Frank is delighted with his brother. God has been very good to us. Although Will and I are separated from our loved ones, God has been very gentle and loving in compensating us. We had a lovely parcel of gifts from Sydney and were able to have our Christmas tree, but the Lord ordered otherwise. A storm has prevented us. Mails are again late through swollen creeks. The wet has now started. Short, fierce monsoonal storms every day, sometimes two a day with heavy rain. Again we praise God for the shelter he provided for us. Side and back skillion of the store, as previously mentioned. It is divided off into rooms, and I have bought a stove practically new for only £5. I have never experienced such a meal. It is so full of trials, difficulties, problems, disappointments, troubles, but the Lord has given victory all along the way. Praise his name. More than conquerors through him that does. We had a delightful time our Christmas tree. 74 being present, it was a great joy to give the gifts to the people, but a greater joy to tell them of the great eternal gift of God. Those words, "And I shall call his name Jesus," became more precious to me as I realised all it means for such poor souls as these dark folk. The people were delighted with their gifts. It was something new to them, and one who knew a little English said, "Much obliged," as we were leaving. The Lord is wonderfully meeting our needs. They're writing on the 10th of January 1931. I'm leaving for Cloncurry, arrived safely. On the next day, we were sent a telegram warning us not to attempt to travel as the weather was too bad. 19 inches of rain had fallen. On the 16th of February, we finally left. We're moving off to Burketown tomorrow. The goods have already gone, and we trust to reach there on Tuesday. Then on the 21st of February, such a rough trip. After leaving Dobbin, it took 22 and a half hours on the mail coach to do 180 miles. The last 5 miles took from 7:30 p.m. Tuesday to 3 a.m. Wednesday. Frank and I sat with the driver, and the bed was made for Dorothy and the baby among the mail bags on the truck. We were tired and stiff on arrival, and so for the moment ends Len's story. Back to Cloncurry. Victor was born on the 21st of December. Very hot morning, and Miss Simmons and Miss Campbell looked after Frank. Well, after a few days in hospital, I returned to them until it was time to go on to Burketown. We got the train from Cloncurry to the Dobbin. That was a matter of about 80 miles because the poor old car, it was just needing so much doing to it, we hadn't got the money to repair it, let alone buy the set of tyres, which in those days cost £90 for 4 tyres. It's almost unbelievable, but so it was, and apparently the Lord meant us to travel by the train and then the mail coach. It was quite an experience travelling on this little train where the passengers all sat around the sides of the carriage, and the train stop two or three times for morning cuppa, lunch, afternoon cup, and the water was provided from the engine. You could have walked alongside it and picked the daisies as you went, but it was quite an experience, especially when we stopped at the little country sidings and where everybody came up to see the train come in case there was someone that they knew on it. On arrival at the Dobbin, we transferred to the mail truck for Burketown, and as Lenz has already said, we travelled with him sitting in the front with Frank, and I sat up among the mail with the baby so that I could have a bed, make a bed for him there. It was mentioned about taking so long to do 5 miles. Well, it was just out of one pothole into another pothole, out of one pothole into another pothole, and you can imagine how it was, bump, bump, bumpity bump, bumpity bump, bumpity bump, for all those hours and that distance. It was called Miller's Plain, the place. I might say that the train took 10 hours to do the 80 miles from Curry to the Dobbin. That little incident along the way on the train, at one of the stops, an old man put his head out the window and he was greeted by quite a few friends there, and one said, "How are you?" He said, "Oh, I'm terrible sicknesses. I've got the diabetes." With a big smile on his face. He was quite important. He'd been down to Brisbane to the hospital and then come back onto this little country siding. As we travelled by the mail coach too, we had a very good time really, because at every cattle station we stopped at, passengers were made welcome, a meal was provided for them, and wash and brush up, everything you needed was provided. It was a time when they welcomed visitors, and we really had a good time on the trip, except of course for the last few miles. That was caused by the black soil being trodden up by the cattle, and then came and then the sun, and it just hardened it like a rock. The mailman, a very rough man, was very good to us, and despite everything, we were glad when they dropped us home in Burketown, the beginning of our work there. Oh, there's one sight I won't ever forget, and that was the blown up carcass of a huge crocodile about 16 feet in length lying on the riverbank near the bridge at Burketown. Must have been dead about a week, and at that juncture it was about 3 foot through. After settling in, my introduction to the people in the town then took me over to the town camp, which was about a mile across the plain from Burketown, and then 2 children were great help, because everybody wanted to see the little fella. And you know, the baby made an opening anywhere, in any country, any race. Heart went out to those people. I've seen some Aboriginal camps, I've seen some of the offscourings of life, but never had I seen such hopeless, neglected looking people as these were. They were in rags, children had running eyes and noses thick with flies, sores on their bodies, adults with their eyes affected by trachoma. They couldn't shoo the flies off, but oh, what rags and tatters, what dirt. And not only that, but the look of utter hopelessness and helplessness. I could imagine just a little how the Lord looked on these people, of people ready to perish, and just thanked him that he had sent us there. There was one old couple I can remember, Jimmy, so very well, and his little wife. They had 13 dogs in the humpy. Of course, they were needed in place of blankets, one behind your back, another across the shoulders, one across your tummy, and then 2 or 3 to fill in various spots, beside which they kept several dogs tied up outside so that they'd get really hungry, and then they'd go off and hunt kangaroos. And that was how they existed, with the help of the handout that they got once a week from the butcher, the baker, and the tea and flour that was handed out for rations. The Lord has prepared their hearts to open to us And when they found we cared, we became Svengalonga me. And we were always welcome. Of course, it made matters very much easier for the two men to have a woman come, because what the men be coming for, that was the question that always arises. Among the little families, there was Daisy and Bob. Bob worked at the hotel, and they had two children, Amy and Riley. There was Sophie and Joe, and the three children. The eldest one, Gladys, and then Helia. Oh, poor little Helia. She was a pathetic sight. She was a little half-caste child with lank, straggling, dirty hair. Her eyes just covered in pus and flies. Really a pathetic little sight. And then there was Wilma. There also was Dalma and Jacob, who had a family. Clara, the eldest girl, became a teacher at school at Dunedin, and she's still there, married now, of course. And then there also was a baby born, little Ruth. We were asked to give her a name, and we called her Ruth. She was a little half-caste baby, and they went to great pains to put some colour, rubbing her in ashes so that she wouldn't look too light a colour, because they were really a little bit ashamed of a half-caste child. And Ruth is still out of Bunji. She's a Christian, she's a fine young woman, and has a family of her own. There were two Maggies, and Daisy appeared to be of some authority among the women, and I got to know her fairly well. And I must tell you one event that took place later on in her life which made a great impression on her and on all the people. She got very sick. I judged she had pneumonia, but she wouldn't go to the hospital, and she stayed in the camp. She was so bad that she said goodbye to her relatives, and there was great crying going on because Daisy had been finished. However, I felt that Daisy hadn't finished, although she was very, very ashy grey and really looked desperately ill. But I believed it was to the glory of God that Amy shouldn't finish. So I prayed with her, and I prayed publicly that the Lord would lift Daisy up on her feet again. And he did. And it was talked of for a long time afterwards, both by Daisy and the others, the day that the Lord lifted Daisy on her feet. So there was no mourning, there was no anything. Daisy lived. She had a daughter, Amy, and a son, Riley. Well, she found a very good way to keep Amy quiet, and that was to give her tobacco to chew. And actually, Amy got quite dopey as she got older. She just couldn't do without tobacco. And when she was taken into the dormitory later on, oh, there was quite a disturbance, because Daisy would come along and push bits of tobacco to her. It was quite a common thing for the women to chew tobacco, and they had the funniest way of keeping it. They'd chew it up into a little ball and then put it in their ear for safety. And on occasion, when they needed a little chew of tobacco, out would come the ball from the ear, and they'd have a good old chew. Then there was the two old women by the name of Mary. One was called Big Mouth Mary, and truly she did have a very big mouth, and she used to open it very wide. And the other Mary, oh, she was so thin, just a long streak, and she had a funny way when she wanted to tell you something and you asked her which way you go, she'd just kind of make a point with her nose in the direction which the person had gone. They had a funny way too of, you say, who went? Two fella myself. And when you worked it out, they meant just yourself and somebody else. Anyhow, two Marys often used to come up to see me, and they wanted to work. Actually, they looked as if they could not do anything, but the very thin old Mary, she told me she was very good at scrubbing. So occasionally I let her do a little bit of scrubbing, but it hurt me a little bit because she was so terribly thin. But she seemed to enjoy it, and it meant a little bit of extra rations for her and all that that she enjoyed very much. They did get meat rations from the butcher, but however they lived and didn't die of some dreadful stomach complaint, I wouldn't know, because sometimes the meat was absolutely green. I wouldn't have given it to a dog. But they just threw it on the ashes, and apparently the burning killed whatever. But the only objection I had was when they'd been to the butcher, they'd stack it up until they went home in the top of the laundry, and it didn't smell too good. Big Mouth Mary had a daughter, Nora, who later became the mother of David Brookdale, and he later on became head man at Wimmagee. One day, walking over to the camp, we heard a funny squawking noise coming from some grass beside a piece of swampy ground, and it sounded like a frog in distress. Well, it was a frog in distress. A snake was trying to swallow it, but it was swallowing it tail first, and out of its mouth there hung the head of the frog, and it was making a croaking. Anyhow, then dispatched the snake, and the frog went free, then hopped away. Apparently it wasn't killed or wasn't going to die. I should tell you where the camp was situated. It was across a barren clay pan. There was perhaps an odd bit of pigweed or something like that until we came to this kind of a little creek. You could scarcely call it a creek if you imagine a creek to have tree-lined banks, but it was just a kind of a runnel across the plain, and over the other side of that was the camp, which consisted of humpies made of bark, old pieces of tin, pieces of whatever they could get hold of, rag, anything. A very miserable place. There was an odd tree or two, but for the most part, all the country surrounding Burttown itself was just plain country, grassless, that in the wet weather was just mud swamps. Burttown itself was situated about 40 miles from the mouth of the Albert River. It had, in time past, been a small township, perhaps, which you could call it, but that was many, many years before, when there was a meat industry, the end of the 1800s, I think that was. But in the time when we knew Burttown, it was a population perhaps of 30-odd white people. There was a hospital, a shire clerk's residence, the post office, the police station where the sergeant of police lived, and the constable's house, a few other odd houses, and the store, which was St. Marion Scholes in those days, a butcher's shop that was opened once a week or a fortnight according to the demand for meat, and there was a Chinaman who had a little store, and also he was the baker. But it was a very barren place. It was described by one person as a town of winds, wasters and washaways, and all along the riverbank that was perfectly true. It was washaways. On the other side of the river from Burttown, it was kind of scrubby country, but we didn't go over that side very much, only once to look at a crocodile that was trapped, another time looking at flying foxes. But Burttown country was just barren, 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 and the town camp was situated about a mile from the town, if you could call it a town. And then beyond there was the lake about 6 miles away, and there were beautiful mango trees out there. It was a little oasis that was further out. By July, we had no word from the Chief Protector of Aborigines as to the land applied for Point Parker. So Len and Will decided to go and inspect it, choose a building site and suitable timber for building. They finally left on the 24th of July in a buckboard drawn by two horses with two black boys and two spare horses. They had great fun getting suitable horses for harness and eventually bought a quiet grey mare with a foal broken to the buggy and a saddle, which pulled well with another horse. Len said the price was rather steep, £4, but they were usually 30 shillings for £2. While Len was away, I began to give treatment to some more of the children, and of course this helped quite a lot, and it gave contact with the children and the mothers. We have been used to going over to the camp about twice a week, but while the men folk were away, I wasn't able to go. It was too hot and too far to walk with the two small children, so they used to come over to see me. At that time I was given a little half Chinese baby by one of the women, and that made us wonder whether the Lord wanted us to start a children's home in Burketown. He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sendeth more strength when the labours increase. To added affliction he addeth his mercy. To multiplied trials his multiplied peace. Mentioning about giving treatment reminds me of some of the older ones. They'd come over and with imaginary aches or pains or something, and then when you finally convinced them that they didn't have anything, they'd say, "Oh well, give it eye water." And of course that was given, because most of them could do with some eye water anyway, because they had such sore eyes. Then another thing, sometimes they'd come along and they didn't know what they wanted, but they'd got the gibbets. So, oh well, they'd end up gibbet soap. So the soap was handed out because that encouraged them to wash their clothes. I had been visiting a dark girl in the hospital, Bessie. She had TB and she was very gravely ill. I had many opportunities of talking to her, and I told her about the Lord Jesus who cared for her and who had prepared for her a home in heaven along a Walmore. Walmore was their word for sky. And she seemed to understand. Later on, the matron of the hospital said she had told her all that I had said. And she said it sounded so strange coming from a black girl. A few days previously to her death, she'd given birth to a puny little baby boy. He was premature and so tiny, and the nurse put some black mittens on his tiny hands, and they dubbed him Jerry Jerome. Jerry Jerome was a noted boxer in that era. And anyhow, eventually he had to be sent away where he could be properly cared for. Another girl I met up in the hospital was Sarah. She was very ill, having kidney fits, and her little baby was born, Clara, and poor Sarah, she was not very well and mentally upset, and one day she threw her baby through a window 6 feet out to the ground because she thought it was a wallaby. Anyhow, the baby survived miraculously. She had a very old husband by the name of Jacob, and they stayed with us for a little while and then went back to the station where they were working. Another time there was an old woman brought in from one of the stations, very ill, put in hospital. So she was terrified, and one day matron went into the room and she was missing. Well, they hunted all over the place for her and thought perhaps someone had come and carried her away to the camp, but that wasn't so. She was so frightened, she got out of bed and she crawled underneath the hospital, which was two rooms for the dark folk, and she crawled as far back as she could. And I tell you, there was fun getting her out from there. We had a small herd of goats, which we needed for milk. Cattle aren't milked up there because they give so little, but goats can find feed anywhere and they milk quite well. Also, we used goats to pull the water cart. They had to go down to the bore for water for washing, and for they were drinking we had tanks, but for extra water they had to go down to the borehead. Two of the girls used to go and take perhaps one or two trips in the morning and get sufficient water for the day. Goats are funny things and they can be very stubborn at times. Particularly one goat we used to call Rainbow. It was a patchy coloured one, brown and white and black, but it was a good puller. Occasionally it would balk. Then when they were let out in the morning they'd wander off away out on the plain, but they always came back at tea time because they were given a bit of feed and shut up for the night. Well, you had to shut them up for the night because of dingoes. They're very, very useful animals, there's no doubt about it. And then sometimes we'd have to kill a young one for meat. There was a butcher in Burketown. He killed an animal about once a fortnight, except at race time, and he'd kill two animals, and he made the most marvellous sausages. People came in from a very great distance round about the sausages. Also, he sold a kind of biltong that the drovers used to take away with them. It was very, very dry meat, just about like leather really, and it had to be soaked before it was cooked. But it did flavour stews and things and was very, very useful. The Chinaman at the shop made bread. Oh, it was beautiful bread, real light and white, a bit different to the kind of bread I used to make, which was much more satisfying really, because you could eat a whole loaf of the Chinaman's bread and not feel satisfied. We didn't get any fresh food apart from the meat and milk from the goats and the bread. Vegetables would be brought in sometimes from the lake, but fruit was confined to just when the Noosa came up the river, which was only in the dry season, and by the time the fruit had been transferred from the boats from Thursday Island down onto the Noosa and then onto the lighter to come up the river, very often didn't last much more than a day. That was the only time when our children tasted a fresh apple or anything like that. Mangoes we could get out from the lake. Especially I remember about the apples, because later on when we were out at Dumagee we had only dried apples, and they have a lot of core in them very often, and Frank would be sure to get core when it was cooked. And one day he said, oh, I would like an apple, a nice round apple. He had remembered that there were such things as nice fresh round apples. However, the Lord looked after us and we really didn't suffer a great deal from the lack of fresh fruit, although at one period Victor, when he was only quite small, had 20 boils on one arm, and the doctor said it was the cause of lack of fresh fruit, and we had to get lime juice and give him lime juice regularly to make up the deficiency. I mentioned that Len and Will were going out to the reserve to have a look at the place and see about selecting a site, and they left on the 24th of July. And after camping at various places along the way, they came out to where Houston, the Afghan, lived. He had a half-caste wife, and he was breeding goats and horses. Gave us a very good reception and killed a goat for us as soon as they arrived. Len said the country is simply wonderful, highly suitable for a mission station, as water can be got anywhere and there's any amount of green feed. Wallabies and kangaroos, sand goannas, wild honey, water lily, every part of the water lily can be eaten from flower to root. There's ducks and fish and crabs, emus and brolgas, there's plenty of wildlife and plenty of food for the dark folk for hunting. I don't know if I mentioned the necessity of having an established mission station where we could have the dark folk and care for them right away from the town. It was because we would be able to keep the children there and the families would be able to stay together. The dark folk had always had contact with white people to their detriment because they no longer lived in tribal life. They were just the offscourings of the earth, and the white folk had never ever helped them. To get them out into a place where they could live and be happy, and where we could bring them to know the oath of God who had sent his son for them as well as for us. I must say, not all the people were, I don't mean Aboriginal people, they were very happy at the idea, but not all the white people, not the Christians that we knew, not all of them thought this was a good idea. They just said, oh, the government should have to look after the people. It shouldn't be the job of missionaries to care for them. But we believed that the Lord meant us to care for the whole man. That accounted for the fact that we didn't get, in those early days, a great deal of support. Everybody was waiting to see what was going to happen. And then, if it happened and turned out well, they'd consider supporting the work. But apart from that, we were kind of not forsaken by a lot of our Christian friends, but they were just standing off to watch. And so we were shut up to God, and it was only by his grace and goodness that kept us going in those first very difficult years when there was little money and little prayer going up for us. We still had going out to the reserve as our great aim. We weren't idle in Burketown. The men folk found plenty to do, either making and preparing tools or making some furniture, because we had nothing actually except beds and a table. So they made what they could out of crates and boxes and so on. And of course we had to look forward to having something to take out to start life anew out on the reserve when we got there. So they found their time occupied also in visiting the dark folk in various places, and sometimes just sitting down talking to the men, getting to know them, which was all vital. Sometimes they were called on to help in outside things, as when the mailman broke down and Len, who had a driver's license,